Okay, bismillah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Just want to welcome everybody, inshallah, to this evening's the virtual salon. It's wonderful to have you all here. It's something that I've not done before. We're just trying something out. And I just want to firstly thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for bringing us all together in this way. And I also want to thank my amazing guests for being so gracious to just say yes, you know, me wanting to reach out to the members of my faith community, you know, as intellectuals, as activists, as scholars, as creatives, you know, to have a conversation. So what we're here to do today literally is to have a conversation. So without any further ado, let us get to our amazing guests. On the panel today, we are joined by the coaches Naila, Nazir and Fatima from Outstanding Relationships. They are polygamy and relationship coaches based in the States. We also have Muna Ali, a documentary photographer based in London. We're also joined by Abdul Wahid Stevenson, who is an imam in South London, founder of Medina College and also a Sharia advisor. We've got Muhammad Muhammad, who is a writer and the co-founder of the Black and Muslim in Britain project. We also have Obeida Mankwa, my son and co-host, who is a sociology student in West Yorkshire. We also are joined by Buna Muhammad, who is a poet, writer, activist and director based in Canada. From across the way, we have Amina Muhammad Diggins, who is an author and entrepreneur based in the States. And also we have Hafsa Dabidi, who is a graduate and author and also founder of the Dabiri Group. We have Imani Bashir, international journalist, expat and author of her own children's book. Bilkis Quick is a mother of four boys and one girl, is the proprietor of Zuhur Designs and an entrepreneur based in Canada. In addition, we have Habib Akande, who in his normal life is a chartered accountant, but is also author of six books on race, religion, and erotology. Then we have Rahma Muhammad, who is a mother of three and author of children's books and a diversity advocate. And last but not least, we have Michael Mumisa, who is from my country, Zimbabwe, and is an academic at Cambridge University. Welcome to all our amazing panelists.
Wonderful, alhamdulillah. Right, okay, I do believe that that's everyone. Now, as you can see, the room is full. We have almost 100 participants, subhanAllah. Right, so we all know that this has been a tumultuous time. And, you know, with the killing of George Floyd and just the culmination of events, that have taken place in the US and have spread really across the world, almost like lighting fires around the world. And I think those of us who have been involved in that have also seen big things happening in the Muslim community as well. Conversations that maybe have not been had before are being had, things that have been suppressed for a long time are being spoken about. So I guess for those of us who are familiar with the Black struggle, particularly the Black struggle in the diaspora, I have a question, and that is, do you think that this latest explosion, this latest kind of peak, is a true moment in the history in the sense that it's a turning point, or do you think that it's more of the same? Do you think that things are really going to change in the United States specifically, but then spilling out? Because I think that we can all agree that this, maybe this level of, I don't know if many people being as vocal, I don't know, again, I'm not the expert here. I'm asking a question because my son is saying, it's revolution, it's gonna change. And I'm saying, we've been here before. So from my panelists, what do you guys think? Do you think that this is a turning point or what's going on? I'm going to give you guys the coaches. Inshallah, bismillah. What do you think?
I'll speak from my heart. I was raised by my grandparents and they got me when I was 40, when they were 40 years old. And I heard stories of revolution and uprising and rioting and change and civil rights era My grandmother's a dark-skinned queen. She's 85. She'll be 86 this month on the 27th, inshallah. Her experience was different in that she was a nurse during the civil rights era, and she was threatened many times for being physically assaulted and different things of that nature. So to hear certain stories that she's told me over the years, until she was diagnosed with dementia, her struggle was different than mine, much different than mine. So I have this privilege of not dealing with dogs and, you know, certain threats, but the story she told me that her mother told her, it's like a repetitive topic. A lot of the actions that happened, a lot of the racism that they faced was very similar. So it just, it sounds like this broken wheel, but at the same time, we're in a different space in time. You know, so it's hitting me differently now as a woman that's over 40 years old. But I have heard these stories before. I've heard her experiences before. I've heard stories of her mother finding, her mother cleaned houses and became an entrepreneur from the bottom up. But she remembers her mother telling her, I found my, you know, the man that she worked for, his grand wizard robe under a cabinet she was dusting. So it feels like we've been here before, like you were saying, sister. But it's just hitting me differently now. It's hitting our children differently. But I've heard these stories from my grandmother, from her mother before.
Quickly going to, we didn't really go into a lot of our detail, but yes, we're coaches. We are, these are my wives. My wife, Coach Fassman, I've been married 25 years, and Coach Nava for 10 years, and we teach on polygyny and personal relationships. So in answer to the question, is my opinion goes a little bit, it feels like the same old thing, but the difference is it's actually different. So it's more of a rebellion right now. So if you're asking me personally, is this different than what we've seen before? Absolutely different than we've seen before. Are there gonna be some systemic changes? I believe so. I mean, there've already been some changes now when it comes to LAPD, for example, chopping off 150 million from their budget and redirecting it. Now there's talk of disbanding police departments. And you see both functions at work here. When I look at MLK and what he did with nonviolence, for example, and people talk about, you know, protests and nonviolence, they get to see up close and personal, based upon our ability to share information on social media and capture it, the violence of the police aggressing against these people. And funny enough, one of a former Panther, a Muslim brother of mine, he shared that back in the 60s and 70s, yeah, there was diversity. But now the level of diversity and people stopping their silence. I was at a protest just the day before yesterday, and maybe 80% of the people were white. And of course, there were some white supremacists and everything that were there, but the different amount of people who are tired of being silent, especially with this manufactured kind of greatest depression that's about to hit us, really is causing a vocal, massive change. And I'm going to stop here because I know it's three of us real quick.
No, it's funny because, not funny, haha, but funny, right. You know, where it goes to the point where I said, now it's being called what it is. You know, at first it was like, oh, you know, sweeping under the rug is something else. It's not that. It's not this. And it's these different excuses about why this is, or if they would only do this, or if this was to be this way. And when you say things like that, that's when it becomes an excuse. That's when it becomes something that you say, you're not saying what it really is. Because if they were doing the same thing to a different race, if they were doing it to white people or anything like that, what would it look like? I remember watching something just real quick, where they said, if you put the narrative, if the words that the media was saying about black people who were rebelling and rioting and different things like that, about something that they should be rioting about, or should be rebelling about, should be saying, hey, listen to me because I'm ready to speak, or, you know, you need to hear me now. We've done what you wanted us to do. Now you got to listen to us. But if you put the words thugs and this and all this other stuff with the descriptions, yeah, with where they're white kids tearing up stuff after a game, after losing a game and all these other things. It was like, oh, where it was a thing gone awry, or, you know, they're just angry kids, or it was just a party that went out of control, you know, and they said, you would have changed the narrative. And they did. They actually took the words and put it in the same context, like put them where the pictures were and or the videos. And it was like, you could see, you know, you could see it, you could see how crazy it was. And it was like, do not let the media, you know, distort your view of what it really is. And that's what it's been. But now with social media, with people really calling it what it is, people are showing showing video.
Ben and Jerry's.
I love that. That would always be the thing. Like Ben and Jerry's really called it out. He's on their About Us page, not only calling it what it is, but also saying what needs to actually be done in order for it to stop, or at least for it to change. That stuff, when you hear more people really calling it what it is and saying what needs to be done, that's where I see the difference. That's where I see where, yes, it's similar things and same stuff that we went through for years and decades and hundreds of years, but now it's being called out for what it really is.
So we're seeing a difference in the sense that the language is spot on. The language is recognizing what we've known has always been the case, right? Imani. Yeah, Imani, you had your hand up, mashallah. Yes.
I think for me, I'm gonna speak on the as real as I can possibly get with it. Especially having this generational anti-blackness that has existed in this country, there has always been resistance. There has always been resistance since the transatlantic slave trade. There has always been revolt. There has always been Black people saying that enough is enough. And then at some point you get to the civil rights movement and you can see women, you know, pictures of women in Somalia protesting the arrest of Angela Davis and people that are protesting the arrest of Martin Luther King Jr. And you can see what it did when El-Hajj El-Malik Shabazz, Malcolm X, went to Hajj and how it is that people received him and had a better understanding of what was going on to Black people in the United States of America. And I think it's no different than what we're experiencing now. I think at some point it's going to have to change as opposed to whether it will change or not. I think it's a matter of at some point we have to know when not to be complacent, because of course we're in a pandemic right now. So it's easy for everyone to be in an uproar because everybody's sitting at home. But what happens when sports are back on TV? What happens when TV is back to its regularly scheduled programming? What happens when we have concerts to go to? What happens when we have so many other things to do that are going to divert our attention that were specifically designed to divert our attention from revolutionary acts, from us really paying attention to what is going on. And I think that's something that's going to be happening literally in the midst of this, of these protests. They announced that the NBA was coming back July 31st. Why now? If you read $40 Million Slave, the brother who wrote it, William Roden, specifically stated that Blacks were only integrated into big sports leagues in order to stop revolutionary acts from happening. And so for me, no, I don't think it's going to be something that obviously is going to change quickly. I think now with social media, it helps. But even still, you have people asking, well, what did they do? They must have done something. They probably, you know what I mean? Well, we don't know the whole story. I saw that with Ahmaud Arbery. Well, we don't know the whole story. And that's always like that with Black lives. And people will always find a way to gaslight us as Black people and diminish our experiences.
No, I totally hear that. And something that I've noticed as well is a lot of people have been sending me analyses by Black conservatives in the US, Candace Owens, people like that, who obviously have, you know, their own kind of take on, shall we say, their own take on, you know, Candace Owens and other people as well, not just her. But yeah, let me go to Sister Bilkis next, inshallah. Go ahead, sis.
Yes, I feel like just mentioning what Sister just was talking about with the COVID, I look at it in a way where I feel like, subhanAllah, Allah has, it appears that things are coinciding, right? Like, people are inside, people had nothing better to do than to watch the news, and they had to see the vivid images. And you know, if they were going to work, if they were, you know, busy trying to make money, if they were, you know, doing their business, it wouldn't have, I feel like it wouldn't have impacted them as deeply, you know. And so you see people outside of the Black community, other people of color, and white people really have been impacted. They appear to have been very impacted by this, right? And because of that, now as well with the COVID situation, and there isn't really anywhere to go, now they can actually stand up and do something, right? And I feel like that's why there's, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people protesting. And I feel like, I mean, there, you know, my parents, especially my father, being a person in the struggle in the 60s in America, you know, he has told me, you know, umpteen stories about the struggle and the way that it was, and seeing that nothing really seemed to have changed since that point, right? And so when I started watching it, I started sort of getting the same feeling where I feel like nothing is really going to come from this, because, you know, Black people have been going through this struggle forever. But then I see, again, like the silver lining of it, when I look at the images on the screen of all of the different colors that are also standing up. And I'm praying, inshallah, that this, you know, this just is an opening. Like the whole situation of COVID and all that was just an opening that Allah has opened up for us, inshallah.
Inshallah ta'ala. MashaAllah, a very hopeful view. Barakallahu fiki. Amina, go ahead, sis.
Speaking with all the other sisters who have spoken, I think we won't know until we know, you know, like, because we've all been here before, you know, talking, like, you know, to my parents, you know, reading history, looking at history, until it's, you know, I see that now people are being called out visibly on their stuff, you know, not using profanity, called out on their BS, you know, until we see like hearts changed, and until we see actual laws that are going to hold police accountable for their actions. And I know that those things are in the works, that we can actually vote on those particular type of things where we can hold police accountable and stop and change laws that have given them immunity, which one of the reasons why, you know, none of them have, a lot of the times when they've been charged or arrested and there have not been any penalties, is because they're the laws that protect them. So inshallah, we'll see that those laws will change. I try not to be too cynical, because then I get kind of down on myself, and it brings my entire morale down. But it has to be genuine. Like, we see a lot of organizations outside of the Muslim community, outside of the Black diaspora community, reaching out. So I'm pretty sure that all of us have gotten inboxes or emails asking what to do. And you have to kind of think about, is it genuine? Because you kind of know, you would think, right? Like, you would know how to fix your own house. I think that we all know how to fix our own houses. It's the wanting to do it and actually doing it. So I think America knows how to fix its house, you know, but whether or not they are committed to change, or if they're committed to white supremacy, the ideal of white supremacy. So we'll see, you know, I take that we'll see when we'll see type of approach, inshallah.
No, subhanAllah. You know, you mentioned the issue of, like, you know, people reaching out and saying, you know, what can I do? How can I help, etc. And, you know, obviously I'm not American, and, you know, I've never lived in the States, and, you know, I only have probably as much proximity as a lot of the British people on this panel do. But, like, we've known about racism in the US, like, forever. So I find it so strange that people are really saying, I didn't know it was that bad. Or, like, tell me your truth. Like, tell me your story. Like, didn't you watch Roots? Like, didn't you watch Roots? Wasn't it on TV? Like, you know, like, I thought we all watched Roots. I thought, you know, we've had riots, we've had, you know, Rodney King. You guys all know Martin Luther King. You all know Malcolm X. You know, everyone knows about the civil rights. Everyone was going crazy about This Is America, you know, Childish Gambino and Beyonce being talking about it. Like, it's like, what do you mean you didn't know? Like, I'm finding it really difficult. And I worry that obviously social media, I think, is showing its power right now, because the narrative doesn't seem to be orchestrated right now. I don't know whether you guys agree. Just unmute if you disagree. I'll spotlight you right away, or if you have something to say on that. Just jump in.
Yeah, I was talking to someone recently, and I mentioned the Tulsa burning and bombing of Tulsa. And like, really? And yeah. I was like, oh, you know, so I think that some people put on blinders, and I think that America's really good about blinders. You know, we're just going to look at what we want to look at and kind of ignore, you know, the house burning down around us. And, you know, people can be just committed to their comfort, you know? So, and our schools don't, unless you, a parent makes a conscious decision to talk to their children about these things, you know, a lot of like slavery nowadays is kind of sugar-coated. They're talking about as far as immigrants, you know, so you see those type of conversations. So you would have to, I guess it depends on the person, but I do think that people choose to be educated or choose to remain ignorant. And I think we all have to, everyone has to hold themselves accountable, you know, but yeah, people put on blinders.
Right.
Yeah, can I speak on that? So I actually agree with Sister Amina. I feel like white America, or especially conservatives in America, like to look at history in a sense of divorce. So they look at it from afar and think, oh, civil rights, that's cool, that's interesting. But they don't actually realize that civil rights was only 60, 50 years ago. They don't realize that this is literally their history. This is stuff that Black people still alive today have gone through and have suffered through. They look at it from a sense of like looking at afar, even though these are people's real experiences. So I feel like with this Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd killing coming to light, this is not new, but it's just that the Black community and even people who are allies to the Black community have made it like pushed in people's face, like, this is the reality. This is what's happening. Look at this. And to the point where people who aren't looking at it, they're called out. Like, I've seen like people like have messaged them, and like racists have been like, they've contacted their school, contacted their college and stuff like that. It's where we have enough allies that it's us against the racists. And we are like on the majority side rather than on the losing end as we've been on throughout this time. So I feel like it may be a trend. Like this may whole thing may be a trend, and people are just like they feel obligated to support it. But in this time of trendiness, we can still make a change, because you can see the Minneapolis Police Department was shut down a lot. So some change is coming, but we need to make it monumental enough so that it's changed for the good, not some few laws here and there, and make sure that this change is enough change for Black people to like have that kind of status that we need.
Thank you so much, Abed, mashallah. There's the Generation Z representative in there, mashallah. I have a question for, because we have Canadians on the panel, and we've got, you know, people living in the UK. And I'm curious to know from you, I know that Canada was feeling quite, you know, satisfied with itself to say, oh my God, look at those Americans. Aren't they a disgrace? And then kind of getting called out a little bit to say, hey, this is not like just an American problem. And I also would love to bring in my Brits as well, because we've obviously had protests here. We've got our young man who I'm sorry, I'm so proud of him, but I always forget his name. The one from Star Wars. The one who's been really, really vocal. What's his name? Come on, you know his name, Hafsa. What's his name?
John Boyega.
Yes, mashallah. So I'd love for some of the Brits or the Canadians to chime in. I've got you, Muhammad. Go ahead.
Yeah, 100%. The UK is not innocent. The UK has and I would say as serious as I can, the UK has a track record of police, or what I prefer to say is state-sanctioned violence. State-sanctioned murder, There's been 1,500 people, black people, who have died in police custody, which is even more insidious because it's all behind closed doors. There's no cameras in there, you know, which is even more concerning. We've got cases like Sarah Reed dying in police custody in the last 5 years. We have Senny Lewis, who died in the same way that George Floyd died when he was complaining about he can't breathe. These cases aren't exclusive to the American experience, and which is even more concerning that the black experience is international. The same suffering, the same trauma that we feel. And I think that's why a lot of black people across the board, from us in the UK following all these stories, is that we feel that trauma. We feel that it's like the trauma is it crosses the Atlantic. It's hurtful. It's also draining. Having to constantly shout, constantly try to educate your peers. And as Sister Naima said, of these inboxes and DMs and messages and emails of how can, and Amina said the same thing, how can other people reach out? It's really not our job to educate the wider community on how not to be racist.
Wow. Say that again. Those of you who are on Twitter, please just be tweeting from this. I need you to say that again, because that's a quotable there. Please say that again.
It's really concerning that from like the Muslim point of view, from the non-black Muslims.
Are we getting there?
I don't know if they're trying to be as sincere as possible, or they're trying to make themselves feel better that they aren't in the wrong. And it's not our job as black people, it's not our job as black Muslims to educate you to not be racist, to educate you to treat your fellow human being with dignity and respect that not only you would expect from morality's sense of view, but as what Allah commanded. It shouldn't be an alien thing. So if we're looking at how this whole state-sanctioned violence, and I genuinely prefer to say this because this is sanctioned by the government, these police departments, these institutions that police black bodies, this is something that's a government control. This is sanctioned by the state. This is funded. This is actually funded by our own taxes. Our taxes go towards public services. And with that in mind, our money is being used to kill our fellow citizens, our fellow brothers and sisters. And that's really concerning. And the UK are equally, if not worse, because it's more insidious, people can't see it, we don't have cameras in custody, is very, very concerning. And even we see it with coronavirus, most of the fines and the aggression on Brits in the UK to get back inside their homes and stuff has been disproportionately affecting black people. So even in a moment of pandemic, there's no resting in being black.
That's it.
This resting is it. In your black skin.
It's and very you know, just you know, to your point, you know, you said exactly this about Corona, and you know the whole situation with you know the juxtaposition of the reliance of a country like the UK on immigrant and you know second generation immigrant families. The reliance on the whole system that is keeping us together. We've talked about this, you know, about there being black and brown people keeping this country going, you know, through the NHS and everything, right? Juxtaposing that moment which really showed all you Brexit people talking about, oh, they're taking our jobs, you know, what they're doing here and everything, just the fallacy really of Britain's, you know, lack of need for these brown people. And, you know, we don't need them here. We don't want them here, right? But then in that same moment when they wanted to commemorate these frontline workers, if you remember the huge furore about the NHS, whitewashing of the NHS, do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah. Where
they had put together this wonderful thing, this wonderful commemoration, no black people in it, no brown people in it. Even though, as Brother Muhammad said, you know, we're in there, you know. SubhanAllah, Hafsa wanted to speak on this as well. Sis, go ahead.
Okay.
So I completely agree with Brother Muhammad. I think that the UK, especially for me, is very scary because it's even more difficult to use the terms like racism and discrimination and anti-blackness, because everybody just pretends as if it's not our issue and it's something that is just very individual to the US. And Brother Muhammad was talking about the idea of over-policing and state-sanctioned violence. And I think that that structurally develops into our medical systems, into our education systems, and all of these things fuel the fact that people can act as if it's not happening. And there's an amnesia surrounding our imperial history and our colonial history to the extent that we don't understand that we're the people that birthed the racism that actually exists in America currently. And I think all of this, for me, Brother Muhammad mentioned the idea of obviously the victims shouldn't be the ones who have the onus to educate people. And I don't know how well that sits with me. I've had that mentality for a very, very long time. And I obviously understand the idea of trauma and us not require like being the people who should have the responsibility to do that. However, I think especially with the climate, I've only seen the benefit in us speaking about our experiences. I've only seen the benefit in us educating people. And I think especially when people are receptive, that's when you sit down and have a conversation. If you said, you know, okay, look, this is my experiences, and someone is questioning your experience, or they are speaking against it, then I think in that moment, do not waste your energy, because there is no point. You can't justify, you can't sort of, if someone doesn't get the injustice, you can't try and, you know, create humanity within them. They either are human or they're not. So I think, you know, education is an important part, and I think knowledge is fundamental to this being revolutionary or not. I think we have to educate ourselves and continuously be thinking critically. And I think especially when it comes to the idea of privilege, you mentioned with the sisters before about not understanding how people can be so blinded to what's happening around them. And I think it's when you've really, because imagine for them, they wake up in the morning and this privilege is a part of their existence. The first thing is that it's hard to separate from that. But the second thing is they might not actually recognize it as a privilege. There's the assumption that everybody sort of has that privilege as well. So for me, it's a bit like, okay, if you can have a conversation with those individuals to help them recognize their privilege, then that goes in a long way. That goes a long way in creating and strengthening allyship within different communities. But yeah, it's definitely, I don't think there's one way of doing it, but I think everybody has to take on the role with which they're comfortable. So if you're not comfortable with educating and you think the trauma is too much for you, then you're very much, you know, that's a position that you can take for yourself, inshallah.
Makes sense. And I think I watched your video where you were talking about this. And I think it's something that goes in like in waves almost, doesn't it? I'm going to go to Muna next and then Imani. But just the idea that there are times when the fire is burning, right? And you're ready to just light them up, you know, like light everybody up with the truth and with your story, with your experience. But I think what I have seen in especially particularly the Black Muslim community, which we are definitely going to go and talk about, is that fire, but then knowing that that fire is also consuming you. So there being a need for times when it's like, you know what, I just can't, like, don't ask this of me right now. But anyway, like you said, everybody's got their way of communicating and their way of getting that message across, mashallah. So if we can be part of the change, then may Allah accept that from us. Sis Muna, you're on, my dear.
I feel like I can't breathe. I've been feeling like this for the past week. It's been a rather intense journey since everything that's happened. All the hashtags, the continuous stories, everything has been deeply personal. And I've had to kind of sit with myself and ask myself, like, why am I being affected by this as much as I am? And it's one of those, the question that you ask, like, did people forget that racism even existed? And to be honest with you, I feel like I forgot. I feel like the experiences that we've gone through with our families, like my father is East African, a Black man, very much kind of singled out when it comes to everything to do with racism. And it just, it's one of those things where we've kind of repressed everything that we've gone through as children growing up in Britain, the little bits of racism that was ingrained in our lives through school life, through university, through the places that we've been to, the ways that our fathers have been treated in the workplaces, all of these things have been emotionally exhausting. And it's almost as though now we are forced to come to terms with everything that we've been through. And that's how I feel. I feel like I've had to sit down with myself. I've had to find the words to express how I feel and why I feel it and why it's making my voice shake. Why is it so deeply personal? And then you start to look through everything in the past, like everything that you've been made to go through and having to accept as the norm, and never having to have come to terms with it until now. So yeah, when people DM you and ask you questions and everything like that, it kind of puts you in a position of, sis, can you do your research, please? Because now you're putting me in a position of utmost pain without yourself realizing. And I think a lot of people are kind of going through the same thing as me right now.
Yeah, no, definitely. Sis Imani, go ahead. Ask for
that. Firstly, I just wanted to say that, number one, Sister Hafsa's sentiment, I feel like we don't say this enough, that Britain is the OG. Like, Britain is the OG of our government, our oppression, our tyranny. Like, Britain is the OG. And so it's interesting to see people like Boris Johnson coming out and speaking about Black Lives Matter.
Oh, my word.
Prince, that pretty much was like, I'm out of here because of how it is that they've treated his Black wife. And so it's so interesting to me that even, you know, so many countries, they're like, oh, we're coming together, Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter. And it's like the people are coming together, but your governments and your systems that you have in place, they don't mirror that. They don't mirror that sentiment, even with the Black people that you have that live in your country as of right now, how it is that you have treated refugees that have attempted to seek refuge and coming to your countries for safety, for food and nourishment and all of these things. It's like, we have seen this anti-Blackness worldwide. I have had the privilege of being able to live in multiple countries of the world. I've lived in China, I've lived in Poland, I've lived in Africa, I've lived in the Middle East. And so I've seen anti-Blackness and what it is that it looks like in many different facets. And so it's interesting to me, especially in the United States of America, when a lot of non-Black people come here that have faced tyranny and oppression in their own communities, they will turn their nose up at us as though somehow we have done something that they did not do in their own countries to be on the end result of the things that we are going through generationally worldwide. And that's something that, for me, I'm not afraid to educate people about their own cultures, because I feel like some people forget what their mothers went through, some people forget what their grandfathers went through. And so sometimes I think it's important, just mirroring what Hafsa said, as far as, you know, I am not afraid of teaching if somebody needs a lesson. Now, if you're somebody that's gonna gaslight me and tell me what it is that I'm experiencing is not real, I'm not doing that. I'm not even taking the time. But if you're somebody who genuinely just happens to live in a bubble, there are people who exist like that, then maybe I can take that time to pull you to the side and say, this is what privilege is, this is what your privileges are, and this is how it negatively impacts these people, and more than so, people that look like me. Also, when it comes to Islam specifically, I've been telling people all week, one of the first things that was commanded upon the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was ikra. Ikra, read. People forget to read. People forget that that is a commandment that he didn't just put, that Allah didn't just place upon the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that he placed upon all of us. You cannot know each other, as Allah says that he created us in tribes and cultures in order to know each other. You can't know anything without learning it first. And so that is something that our community seems to continue to sidestep in their, what it is that they think they know versus what it is that they should know. It's very similar with the pattern that I'm 33 years Muslim, my father's 67 years, you know what I mean, Muslim. And so even every year during the holy month of Ramadan, we are told to read the Quran. And everybody else can maybe, you know, say yes or no to this sentiment, but wallahi, every time, every Ramadan, I get something new. I get something new that I've read from this Quran that I've had my entire life, that we have had for 1,500 years. You know what I mean? And that's because every time you
ascend in your knowledge. Every time that you read more, learn more, and experience more, experience is the best teacher. But also when you implement the things that you have learned, you become ascended, you become accelerated in your deen as a Muslim. So I implore everyone, if you have friends and family and people that have these ignorant sentiments, sit them down and tell them, they, number one, they need to read first. Read their Islam, because a lot of people don't know their Islam. They think they know, but they don't know their Islam. The story of our first prophet, Adam alayhi salam, it lets us know that arrogance and pride and racism does not exist here. And we see that Iblis turned into Shaitan like that. Is that the kind of person that you want to be? So that's the learning tool that I implement whenever it is that I'm trying to help non-Black Muslims understand where it is that their privilege will get them. If you think that you're somehow better than someone, if you think that somehow their problem is so far outside of you that you are not going to stand up for the oppressed prayers are going to meet us on the day of judgment, not the privilege.
SubhanAllah. Whoa, okay. No, 100%. Habib, go ahead.
Yeah, I love what everyone is saying. I just want to add my 2 pence on it. In terms of whether do we have an obligation to teach white people or non-Black people about racism, I wouldn't say we have an obligation, but I think those of us who've got the energy and capacity to do so, I agree with what Hafsa said and Imani as well, that I think we should, because at the end of the day, if we're not going to say anything, they should educate themselves. Where are they going to turn to? Like, it's easy to say, go to Google and find out yourself, but it's like sometimes they want to find out, okay, what's the books to read or who the people shall speak to first. And to be honest, as a man, speaking obviously as a man that's got male privilege, obviously I'm in my mid-30s, it's still taking me over almost 30 years to understand male privilege. Now, when people asking, okay, why is it white people? Why would I want to get rid of my privilege? If I'm benefiting from it, why am I going to give that for a woman? Do you understand? I'm not saying that to be facetious, but I'm saying if you're a person of privilege, generally you were not going to want to give it up unless it's forced from you. And that's just the reality. So where, and someone said previously about that a lot of white people have got blind spots, and I agree with that. And I somewhat blame them and I somewhat don't. And I'm speaking of white people, non-Black people in altogether, because some of them are not, like you mentioned, someone mentioned, I think it was Naima mentioned earlier about Roots. Many white people haven't seen Roots. Many white people don't even really know who Malcolm X is.
Wow.
As shocking as it sounds, a lot of white people, we think, like when we see these celebrities, like there's some white people I work with, obviously I work in the corporate industry, and a lot of white people, the only Black people they know of is Beyonce.
Is she really Black?
Okay, that's some conversation. But I'm just saying that this idea that white people, non-Black people, are educated of what the similar experience that we have, a lot of them, they're oblivious to it. And as far as they're concerned, why should they know about it? Why should they educate themselves about systematic racism and what's going on with Black people? And I'll be honest, there are issues that are going on in other communities, but it's only when people bring it to my attention that I'm made aware of it. So I've got a Chinese friend that was speaking to me about the discrimination that he suffered amongst Black people, Nigerians in the UK, when he used to go to like hip-hop events and comedy stores, and when they would speak about, like, and I didn't even think about it. It's only when someone else, a friend of mine, told me, then actually reflected upon it. So again, I'm not saying this to give white people a pass, don't get me wrong, but I'm just saying a lot of them, they have got a blind spot, and a lot of non-Black people have got a blind spot. But it's, I'm not saying it's out obligatory, but if anyone who's got the energy and the capacity should try and give some time to kind of educate them or point them in the right direction. Sometimes I do feel like, you know, like, is it Fannie Lou Hamer said, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. But in other times, I'm thinking I should be optimistic, because this idea that because it's 2020, racism should end. I don't understand when people say that. Racism is not going to end. Anti-Blackness is not going to end. And I'm not saying that so we don't fight it. We still fight against it and fight for justice. But anti-Blackness is going to exist until, I think, the end of time. It's always been around. Racism has always been around. And I don't think we can eradicate it completely. I think one thing we should, particularly as Black people, because I'm not concerned with teaching non-Black people about Black oppression and Black trauma. I'm concerned with empowering Black people so we don't have an inferiority complex and teaching us the importance of group economics. Because if we're empowered and we've got our own institutions, we're doing our groundwork, we don't really need to be concerned about what other people are doing. I'm not talking about state violence and police brutality. Yeah. That's something totally different. But in terms of, especially particularly amongst younger people, I'm seeing now that a number of non-black people in particular, and it's quite cringeworthy, are speaking about how black people at the bottom, black women are the most less desirable women. And I'm like, no, wait. Yeah. I'm like, I told them, no, that's in the eyes of you people. You've got the issue. It's not us that, well, there is some black people that, some black men in particular, that's another conversation altogether. But I'm saying this idea that we are inferior, I think that that's quite dangerous. That we need to make sure we don't develop that inferiority complex. Yes, we're systematically oppressed. Yeah. I don't feel inferior to any white person or any Asian person or any Arab person. And I think particularly as Muslims and black people, we should see ourselves that we're blessed to be Muslim and we find some challenges being a black person, but not let that seep into our consciousness where we develop this inferiority complex. That's the only thing I kind of wanted to add on that.
You know, I agree with you 100%, but I want to just challenge you on that about anti-blackness has always existed. Historically, is that a fact? Because I'm just going back now beyond the time of white expansion. Okay, so, and this is, and please, I know we've got amazing scholars and historians in here, so I really do want to kind of educate myself, because my understanding was that obviously we know that different peoples, you know, existed and flourished all around the world. And, you know, the first contact that Europeans had with non-white people, there was a mixture of awe, because some of them were pretty awesome, you know, like some of the civilizations that they went to, the places that they went to, there was this kind of awe, and then also, what can we get out of this? Oh, they've got some pretty cool stuff. And then, you know, so those voyages of discovery, were they racist at that point? Was there always a sense of superiority? Because the thing is that white society and white civilization has not always been dominant. It hasn't always been the top civilization. It hasn't always controlled the narrative as far as the rest of the world is concerned. So is it actually a fact that it's always existed? There's always been anti-blackness, or is it a function more of white dominance and white control of the narrative, and then white people needing to make sense of the world in the way that they do, and then of course us reading their books and us listening to them? So I'm just going to throw that out there. I've got lots of hands up everywhere. Habib, do you have something to say on that, since I was challenging you in the first place?
No, I'm glad you did challenge me on that, but this anti-blackness predated white colonialism or European colonialism. The idea that it's white people that invented, white people invented scientific racism, as what we understand racism to be. But in terms of anti-blackness, where certain people thought being being darker in skin is less attractive or less desirable, that was even in existence during the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
I'm actually looking further back. I'm going back to the
Hindus. But again, my point is that it's looking in if you're looking at history from the perspective of, for example, maybe the ancient Indians that looked at darker-skinned people as being inferior, that's their issue. But it doesn't mean that anti-blackness always existed, for example, in Africa, in black African countries. So I think my issue is that we're always looking at what did white people say? What did the Arabs say? What did the Asians say?
Yeah.
Sometimes I don't care what they said, because they've got their own issues. Yeah. Do you understand? I'm getting that. But 100%. I'm saying there's always going to be, whether it's tribalism, whether it's nationalism, whether it's racism, there's always going to be divisions within human beings, I'm saying. Now, some of it is going to be by the color of your skin. Sometimes it might be by this idea of a caste system. Sometimes it might be class. But I'm saying anti-blackness, or people that's speaking ill of someone maybe that looks different, in recorded issue, from what I'm aware of, and please educate me if someone can tell me otherwise, that's always been in existence with people that have come into contact, unfortunately, with black people. It doesn't mean black people are inferior. It's just that the other people have got that issue. And they've used that against black people. But to always frame it as if it's always the white people, the Europeans, when unfortunately, and this especially is hard, hard pill for a lot of Muslims to take, is that a number of Arabs were expressed anti-black sentiment, particularly against black women, which predated the Europeans. And if we're not ready to tackle that, and we're speaking about the white people, the Europeans all the time, and then we'll talk about, okay, what about the Arabs? What about even in Muslim countries today, where they'll speak ill of black people or black women? How can we don't talk about that? So even this framing as if it's always about white people and Europeans, why are we always centering their narrative or their history or their books as that's the most important thing, when history didn't start in Europe, from what we know?
Please, whoever's quoting, tweeting, Instagramming, storying, please put that, because I love the way that you mentioned that, the centering of the narrative. And I think that we also fall into that. I mean, we do, of course, because, you know, we live in a white supremacist dominant culture. But I do agree with you that the way forward for any oppressed people or any marginalized people is to start to center their own narrative, is to start to strengthen their own internal narrative. Because just as you said, anti-blackness didn't exist in black countries. It didn't exist in black lands. You know, Africa itself didn't have a problem with the way that our women look, with the way that our men look, with the way that our hair is, our noses are. That was our normal, and that's what we loved. And, you know, I think tapping back into that, and I think a lot of us are parents here, so I think a lot of us are very aware of the need to educate our children and inculcate that self-love in our black children when it comes to their features and their hair and just who we are as a people. I think I agree with you, Habib, that is definitely a way for us to reclaim the narrative and not center the white gaze or the white perspective on who we are as a people, because yeah, that's their thing. So I've got lots of hands up here, mashallah, jazakallah khair. I'm gonna go to the coaches first. They had their hands up for a while, then Imani, then Hafsa, inshallah.
Hey, assalamu alaikum. You know, one of the interesting things when we even get into history or talk about the U.S. in particular, the U.S., it must be understood that the U.S. is the pinnacle of white supremacy. They've achieved such, even with the educational system, for example, to call something the transatlantic slave trade because they want to distance themselves from it, when in reality, it's the European American slave trade. So when the General Education Board under J.P. Morgan Chase and Wentworth and all this in the early 1900s ago, you're not going to hear, you're going to hear your heroes, the inventors, and all these individuals are white. So it is no surprise when you wake up and your Marvel superheroes are white and everybody else around you is white that they're oblivious to what's going on. And we, in particular, are oblivious to going on, even black Muslims. So, for example, 101 years ago, we had Marcus Garvey. And he did what no black person still has yet to do, 101 years ago with an eighth grade schooling education. You're talking about somebody who made Black Star Alliance, who had ocean liners doing business with Africa. Uniting people all across the world, saying it doesn't matter where you got dropped off at, we still come from a certain place. And hotels, manufacturing facilities, all these types of things, but the person and people who bring it down was W.E.B. Du Bois, who's praised in a lot of our history, Malcolm or and Marcus is buried. Or you go back to the time of the Prophet, where many Muslims don't know about the blackness that went on. You talk about somebody who came from the lineage of an Egyptian woman who married our father, Ibrahim, right? So he has Egyptian heritage through him, and he was known as having wheat skin, basically being light skin or brown skin. So, or in his own household, you have Osama bin Zayd. When he was asked to lead the army, you know, companions had an issue that he was young. He was 17, 18 years old. He was a boy. They looked at him as a boy, and he had vets, right? But they didn't say, oh, because he's black, but he was black raising his house, right? So we look at these different people and we don't know our history. We don't know that black women been down from day one, A1 from day one. The very first Shahada, the very first Shaheed was a black woman in Islam. I didn't know Sumaya radiallahu anha was a black woman forever. And I've been Muslim over 25, 20 some years now. And I had no idea of that. And it's not like, oh, it doesn't matter. It actually absolutely does matter for a reason. Or the first person to call to these different places, Bilal radiallahu anha. These holy sites of Islam and why and the way the Prophet ﷺ positioned and destroyed these different things, we don't know as black Muslims. And many Muslims aren't knowing, let alone our culture. And I know I'm light-skinned, I'm like the Malcolm or Huey, so there's the whole colorism issue that goes with us as well. But I think when you're talking about history, we're talking about the Greeks were going to ancient Africa and Kemet to get knowledge. So no, anti-blackness hasn't always been there. That's been looked at as the pinnacle. But obviously, we know that that ism or that division has been there because that's been before our creation. And the jealousy of our creation, I think Ibn Jawzi said it best. He said, you know, Shaitan says three things about the human being. He says, one, you know, I can see you, you can't see me. I can see you, you can't see me. I have one goal, you're distracted with a whole bunch of different things. All right, and I'm old and you're new. Meaning he knows our desires, our temptations and all these different things. While we can't really see a lot of this division because, I mean, racism, if you will, not until Bacon's Rebellion in the 15th century where poor white indentured servants, Irish servants, rebelled and united with enslaved Africans here in the United States, did that term even really come about, where now it's based on the color of your skin being enslaved over here in the United States. So it's like, hey, at least we're not niggers. You know what I'm saying? We're white. least we're not niggers. We're poor. We're being oppressed. All this type of stuff. But at least we're not niggers.
Yeah.
You know, so that whole racism began to build. So the U.S. is the absolute pinnacle of it. And in doing so, you have to continue to control the narrative through mass media, which was great when it was just TV. Because that just, you know, a lot of people really began to see a lot of the brutality. But now with this independent media where now you're capturing cameras, now you have from different angles. Every 5 minutes, Sean King is showing another state-sponsored terrorist crushing people with their batons or stepping on them or kicking them. That begins to open up the different world. Like, damn, what world have I been living in?
Yeah.
What's really going on? So I'm cautiously optimistic in looking at what's going on because now there's a different flavor going with it. But at the same time, we still know where we are and we still know what they think of us. If that makes sense.
Yeah. I'm going to go to Imani and then Bilqis and then Amina, inshallah.
So I'll be very short and just going back to my sentiment about Adam alayhi salam. When we talk about, you know, how long racism has existed from, and, you know, anybody with better Islamic knowledge than me, I'm always ready to learn. But from what it is that I interpreted from the Arabic that's in the Quran, that Iblis said he would not bow to Adam because he was made of black mud, black clay. And so I think when we make that differentiation, as opposed to just saying he said he didn't want to bow to him because he's made of fire and that Iblis was made of fire and that he was just made of clay, as opposed to black clay, it changes the dynamic of what it is that we're talking about in this conversation. And so for me, this is what I know the interpretation to be, was that Adam was made of black mud and black clay. And for me, with that being the first example of man, that is the very first example that we have of racism. Racism is a power structure. It is a power structure, and people forget that. No, it doesn't have to be white people that can be the only ones that are racist. Arabs can certainly be racist. It is a power structure in saying that I have something over you. I have some type of dominance over you in which I can oppress you. We've seen that in ancient Egypt with the Sphinx. I lived in Egypt. We've seen that with them seeing these things that black people built. And it's like, how do I not have a monument like this? To me, that is anti-blackness. That is racism. And so I think there are nuances of anti-blackness and racism that exist. I think we just don't gear it in that direction because either it is that we don't want to see it that way, but I feel that Allah has placed it in front of us for it to see it all throughout time. That is not a new concept, but that it has changed and developed and accelerated in various ways.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Thanks so much, sis. Okay, Bilqis, go ahead.
Yes, just speaking on the Canadian situation, I don't know why people fail to remember that when the European pirates brought slaves to North America, they also brought them to Canada. And they brought them to the Caribbean. So, you know, in this whole situation, it's including Canada and it's also including the West Indies as well. Now, my mother was struggling. She came from Jamaica as a young child, and she was in the 60s in Canada in the Black movement here, you know, and it was very similar to the American situation. Canada is just the younger brother of America. And, you know, when the brother is saying that America is the pinnacle of it, Canada has it. And so when we're speaking about the systemic issue, you know, all of this, institutional, racist, oppressive things that we need to break apart, Canada is definitely involved in that, and a lot of the policies are very similar to America. And just speaking on whether, you know, Black people, you know, need to educate other people of color, because you know, in my sphere, that's what it is. It's other people of color in Canada that are, you know, in my spaces and that have been asking me, and you know, I feel like you're tired, right? You're tired because this is not a new thing, you know? And I try to speak to my parents about it. They're beyond tired, okay? it's been forever, right? And you're trying to explain this to people. And you really want to say, go study the history of the country that you live in. Like, you came here, you're profiting, your parents have come here, they were maybe fleeing oppression, genocide, whatever, but they came here for a better life, you know. And a lot of people of color, their parents came here with wealth as well, right? And education. And they came here and they're prospering, you know, and they're just not understanding the history of the country that they live in and you know, who built the country, right? Mm-hmm. And we're not even just speaking of, mentioning the Aboriginal brothers and sisters, like, you know, that, you know, took the first blow kind of thing. So I just feel like people really need to really educate themselves, right? And you want to say, oh, it's the onus on the Black people because, oh, it's your struggle, whatever, you know, people always educate, you know, if it's about Palestine, all the Palestinians come out and they try, you know, we're tired. I mean, I don't know about the other African-American brothers and sisters that are on this thing, but like, me just being up here in Canada, and I live in Canada, okay, I'm already tired. I could just imagine how it is for them down there having to deal with other people of color. And I'm also including, you know, sorry to say this, I'm also including our other African brothers and sisters.
Speak to that.
You know, better situation, you know, they came here, a lot of times they came here with education, with money, you know, they were the, you know, the higher class in, you know, their situation. That's how they got here, you know, and they just really don't have the same experience. And, you know, mashallah, I feel like this is the rally for the, you know, racism of all, you know, trying to somehow eradicate the racism of all Black people around the world, you know, and inshallah, this is the catalyst. But in this current situation, in this current moment right here, I feel like, you know, all of the other people of color, especially our African brothers and sisters, need to go towards the Afro-American, Afro-Caribbean, Afro-Canadian brothers and sisters and really lift them up, because this is a struggle that they have been fighting for since the pirates brought them here, okay? Since the pirates brought their ancestors here, okay? And it's so rooted, and for you to actually understand, you need to start studying, you know?
I think, you know, just what you mentioned, Bilqis, thank you for sharing that. Let's breathe. Whew, take a breath. Those of you who are on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, if you want to use hashtag the virtual salon and hashtag race and religion, and you can tag me and I'll repost. But just to touch on one thing before I go to Rahma next, because she hasn't had a chance to speak, inshallah, then Sister Amina. But the fact that, you know, I think... talking about people of color within the Muslim space, I think a lot of Muslims, of course, there's been the whole people of color line, okay, where basically the idea is that, you know, POC people have aligned, you know, their goals are aligned, right? So we don't have to say Black, we don't have to say brown, we can just say people of color and put them all in there. And I think maybe a lot of Muslims feel like, well, we're oppressed too. Like, as Muslims, we're stigmatized, we're oppressed, we're discriminated against, we have laws against us, right? And I feel that there's a lack of understanding about the fact that everyone is privileged in their own space, right? Everybody enjoys a level of privilege, right? And I'm gonna go from, you know, for example, somebody mentioned colorism. And so in certain spaces, lighter skinned Black people are privileged, right? I'm gonna put my hand up and say that I have niqabi privilege, because in certain spaces, I am more palatable to the community because I wear the niqab. I'm also racially ambiguous, So people don't necessarily know that I'm Black. So I'm very aware of my privilege in that sense. Somebody who's educated, no matter their race, they've got a sense of privilege in certain areas. And within the Muslim community, we have Muslim men who enjoy Muslim male privilege. And then we have the dominant Muslim cultures. If it's an Arab community, there's Arab privilege. If it's a Desi community, there's Desi privilege. If it's Gujaratis, you know Gujaratis are on top, right? If you're in a Somali community, you've got Somali privilege, right? So them not, I think that I really want to kind of segue into the conversations that have been taking place within the Muslim community, because there has been what I've seen, like a sense of almost outrage that Black Muslims dare align themselves with other Black people who are not Muslim, right? And then turn around and point to the community and say, y'all got it too. Y'all racist too, you know? And I think, and I really would like us to talk about that, because I want to know how you feel about these, all these conferences, right? And these people jumping on lives and everybody's like, you know, now it's like the thing. So tell me like what your thoughts are. Enjoyed this conversation and you would like to become part of the virtual salon family, consider becoming a patron. From just £5 a month, you can get access to our chat community, to be invited to our live sessions, and get exclusive content that we only create for our patrons. Be part of the movement. Sign up on Patreon today.